Good evening. I'm Dr. Rachel Baker of the Psychoanalytic Center, and I'm very pleased to welcome you to what I am sure will be a most pleasurable evening. We're very fortunate to have here the collaboration of a good old friend of the center, Klaus Roy, a well-known, multifaceted, creative man of musicology fame, and a rising piano star, Michael Schneider. I'm looking forward to this evening because I had the pleasure of witnessing their collaboration at a verb ballet performance in which a composition by Klaus Roy was played by Michael Schneider to perfection. So here's Klaus to get the ball rolling.
Fix me up, Tom. Thanks to Dr. Peterson. Can you hear me all right? Very good. Thank you. Not loud enough. There is the master. How is this? So I'll talk louder then, okay? Can you hear now? All right. Thank you, Rachel Baker. Ladies and gentlemen, good evening and many thanks for coming to this birthday party, which celebrates two extraordinary individuals, both long gone, but in the truest sense, immortal. Both Mozart and Freud have contributed immeasurably to human well-being, and we can hardly imagine our lives without them. Igor Stravinsky, from his podium in Paradise, has sent a happy birthday greeting to both of them. Been devised for this benefit event, which tries to pay tribute to both of these geniuses of our civilization. It is in three parts. After some introductory comments, Michael Schneider will play two of Mozart's finest pieces for piano solo, after which I shall, with the invaluable help of Dr. Maynard Solomon, try to outline the relationship between a father and son, which did not always, as the saying goes, come up roses. Then, after a brief intermission, our outstanding pianist will return to play two or three more pieces, and you will thereafter leave with the feeling, we hope, that you have been musically rewarded and psychoanalytically intrigued. And all that in the framework of helping this remarkable organization continue to do its beneficial and much needed work. Let me express appreciation to Betsy Kahn for her skill in producing our handsome program booklet. I have been told that Sigmund Freud, despite the brilliance of his mind, was not particularly musical. And I don't know what Mozart's music had to say to him, but he might have been fascinated that his own birthday followed Mozart's by exactly 100 years. And also by the psychoanalytically interesting relationship of father and son, one a talented and competent musician, the other an incomparable genius. In a fine Plain Dealer birthday article last January, Donald Rosenberg wrote, "Whatever his age, Mozart is always with us. Nothing else but music matters where Mozart is concerned. it is instructive and fun to delve into biographical details to discover where one artistic experience led to the next. But only when we open our ears to the transporting qualities in Mozart's music can we begin to understand why his birthday should be noted at all. Unquote, and amen to that. There was a time not very long ago when Mozart was regarded by people interested in music as a kind of porcelain figure, a cute little sculpture you could stand on the piano, and a purveyor of pleasant but not particularly important music. Certainly not a composer to stand comfortably next to a Beethoven or a Wagner. Over the decades, we have discovered that that kind of assertion was many kilometers off the truth, and that we had here a creative artist of such immense expressive range that a comparison with Shakespeare would be much more appropriate. Yes, Mozart could be charming, he could be entertaining, ingratiating, but when we hear the D minor and C minor piano concertos, are enthralled by his deep-going understanding of human nature in Don Giovanni and Figaro, we begin to comprehend that we are dealing here with the ultimate in musical creativity and comprehensive range of expression. We hear a lot about the so-called Mozart effect, especially on small children. Opinions differ whether or not hearing his music makes us smarter, but continued and repeated exposure may in some way make us more sensitive or even wiser. Schubert and Tchaikovsky adored him, even worshipped him. Delius couldn't abide his music. That was his loss. Chacun a son goût, I suppose. Just now, Oxford University Press published a book that would be of great interest to us. It is entitled, For the Love of Music, Invitation to Listening. The joint authors are Michael Steinberg and Larry Rother, both distinguished scholars and leading program annotators of major orchestra, especially the San Francisco Symphony. One of the valuable and stimulating essays is called Another Word for Mozart, written by Dr. Steinberg. I would like to quote a few sentences from that article. Not once did Mozart call himself Amadeus, a form appearing only in the baptismal register. He himself liked the French and Italian forms Amadei or Amadeo, except for one time of fooling around when he signed himself Wolfgangus Amadeus Mozartus. The name is merely a posthumous solemnization of a very serious but blessedly unsolemn man. Mozart's dark side came as a surprise to me when I was a boy. I was completely unprepared for the turbulence of the great G minor symphony. I also remember being confused because Mozart couldn't seem to make up his mind whether he was writing happy or sad pieces. Michael Steinberg continues, Mozart is so complete. He touches us everywhere, mind, heart, and senses. We delight in the richness and generosity of his invention, which his contemporaries often found overwhelming and disturbing. The inexhaustible plenty of melodies, those recklessly rich harmonies, the amazing sense of instrumental color. Simplicity and complexity come natural to him, and in equal measure. He is funny, too, though it makes me sad that audiences today seem not to be trained to hear that or to respond to it. He knows pain, but he never feels sorry for himself. Neither does he beg us to feel sorry for him. And I suppose that is the special Mozart characteristic, the exquisite balancing act between the passion, the roiling emotional content, and the unshakably perfect manners. Almost unshakable, I should say. There are two or three places in Mozart where the surface cracks. where for a moment the harmonies and the rhythm reveal him to have been a potential master of excess. All Mozart lovers know and cherish those places, and cherish them the more because they are so extremely rare. It is in that perfectly calculated tension between center and surface that we find the essence of Mozart. Unquote, Michael Steinberg. When Richard Strauss's favorite librettist, Hugo von Hofmannsthal, was only 19, he wrote that Mozart represented more than the rhetoric and passion of other great composers, namely form, an ideal of structural perfection. Now, we have all seen and heard the use of classical music for TV commercials of certain products. Personally, I hate the idea of Beethoven's Fifth trying to sell me a Pontiac, or the Ode to Joy in the Ninth Symphony underlining God knows what. But recently I encountered one I liked, the ad for the butter substitute Smart Balance, with the last movement of Mozart's Eine kleine Machmusik in the background. Smart Balance indeed, a perfect fit. A number of you may have recently watched the TV program on the architect Frank Gehry. And at one point he remarked that he occasionally looked at a detail on a completed building of his and thought, just where did that come from? And I sometimes wondered whether Mozart ever said something like that when he looked at certain fantastic places in his scores, or whether he took those flights of fancies just for granted. In thinking what to say about the individual pieces you will hear performed today, I suddenly remember to my shock that in 1954-55, that's almost 52 years ago, I had written an 80-page set of program notes for the Haydn Society of Boston, which wanted to issue a multiple set of recordings comprising Mozart's entire output of solo piano works. The pianist was to be the noted Viennese Mozart specialist, Lily Krauss. Maybe some of you have recordings by her. She was wonderful. I was lucky to be able to find my somewhat fragile carbon copies of that set. And as a struggling young music librarian instructor at Boston University, I had literally knocked myself out to accomplish that demanding task by the deadline. I was paid a fair amount at the time, the dollar being worth a good deal more than it is today, and the recording was eventually issued. My notes were not. The booklet remained unpublished, since the society was in serious financial straits. So what else is new? And so, with your kind permission, or even without it, I shall draw on my antediluvian notes and condense them mercifully for this occasion. I doubt that the Haydn Society, long and regrettably defunct, will be in a position to sue me for copyright infringement. Now, when Mozart was in his mid-teens, he was already renowned for his astonishing improvisations on the keyboard. Fully completed sonatas were at that time not particularly useful to him. So he wrote down his first real sonata when he was already 18 and followed it with seven more, the later ones influenced by the gallant Mannheim style of the time. They are, of course, delightful works, but the first of the so-called great sonatas began under the influence of Mozart's visit to Paris in 1778, when he was 22. The A minor sonata, which you will now hear, brings us to a key that meant for the composer something of special expressivity. It is quite possible that the two aspects of the time caused him to write a work of more serious nature, even of personal import. The first was his experience in France was largely unsatisfying, both in the response of the public and the apparent lack of interest by publishers and patrons. The second and more important cause was the news of the death of his mother, who had been left by him in Mannheim, a loss that must have affected him very deeply, then and even later. In any event, the beginning of this sonata is granitic, a note hardly heard in his work for the piano before. The development of the themes, with its fiercely agitated left hand, is filled with dramatic expression and an inexorably driving rhythm. The dynamic motion is not relaxed for a moment. The slow movement begins calmly enough, yet suddenly the storm breaks loose with a series of biting dissonances and only grudging resolutions. No letdown is apparent in the presto finale. While custom dictated a lighter and more congenial ending, this movement is a piece of pointed propulsion with a rhythmic drive sustained for no fewer than 142 measures. A central episode in A major, in the style of a musette of French country dance, affords a momentary glimpse of light before the eerie shadow play of the rondo returns. The hammer blows with which the sonata begins also close it, with an impact as if played by brass instruments. Please welcome our distinguished pianist, Michael Schneider, to play Mozart's great sonata in A minor, special number 330. Mozart in Paris, the age of 22, and he's angry. Thank you also to Alyssa Schneider for efficient page turns. The Adagio, the Adagio in B minor, the key very rarely used by Mozart, dates from March of 1788, 10 years later, when the composer was preparing for the composition of Don Giovanni. Alfred Einstein, the great Mozart biographer and cousin of the physicist Albert, calls this one of the most perfect, most deeply felt, and most despairing of all his works. It may have simply flowed from Mozart's pen in an hour at once tragic and blessed. It is indeed one of the most affecting pieces of music to have come down to us. Its emotional sphere is one that we associate with the romantic. All thoughts of the harpsichord and small early piano have long since vanished. The composer had at his disposal a larger instrument with an extended range in the bass, and he could make use of all degrees of touch and dynamics. He shows us how musically meaningful could be the technique of crossing hands, not just for the sake of display. Watch this, you will see. The tonalities move through a succession hardly anyone had explored quite that way, from the original B minor through G major, F sharp minor, G minor, A minor. And the last measures offer us a welcome surprise, a shift to B major, something that must have intensely moved the young Franz Schubert when he first encountered it. We too may hear it as a gesture of consolation. In this priceless piece of music, we see most poignantly how tears can suddenly turn into a smile, and the other way around. The harmonies may remind us of an iridescent rainbow, or even more of those strange puddles near the sidewalk after the rain, with their scintillating colors, so that we take special care in stopping across them for aesthetic as well as practical reasons. Here is Michael Schneider to play the B minor Adagio for you. Thank you, Michael, for these very sensitive performances. You see how Schubert must have loved that ending. We are looking forward to hearing you again in the latter part of the program. Now, as the program cover comes to you, you see a beautiful picture of a red rose, long a symbol of love and affection. But on the stem, we can discern several thorns that threaten to hurt us if we pluck the flower, just as Goethe describes it in his song Heidenröslein, the hedgerows, set to music so memorably by Schubert. Indeed, the relationship of Mozart the elder and his son was both intimate and contentious, both mutually concerned and equally thorny. In the book I mentioned earlier, Michael Steinberg succinctly sums up the issue. He says Wolfgang was a child prodigy. That's a species not held in much regard nowadays. But Mozart, immensely gifted and shrewdly managed by his ambitious father, enjoyed a phenomenal career for a few years. He did not have an easy journey through adolescence into adulthood, partly because that is never easy, but not least because his father, himself a distinguished musician, did his best to imprison his son in childhood. The child was 31 when his father died. And equating Mozart with innocence, presenting him as a child, a pre-Freudian child, of course, is an idea that has never quite gone away. Unquote Michael Steinberg. Now, Peter Schaeffer's remarkable but dangerously misleading play, Amadeus, has done its share to contribute to that misunderstanding, largely by showing us a Mozart as an idiot savant, a cartoon figure, as his rival Salieri may have wished to imagine and characterize him. In a letter, Mozart claimed that he was not a poet, not a painter, but a musicus, a mere musician. Now, to take up that theme, I am not a psychiatrist, I am not a psychologist, but on an astronomically lower level, I too am a musicus, and only that. So in order not to appear in this context as an impostor, as a pretender to knowledge I do not possess, I shall draw on the writings of a man we unfortunately were not able to engage for this evening, the highly distinguished scholar and author Maynard Solomon. In his outstanding Mozart biography of 1995, he proves that his expertise extends to psychoanalytic insight. While I would be on shaky grounds discussing the Oedipus complex or even the Electra complex, Dr. Solomon could do so. If there's any discussion at the end of this program, I would have to leave responses to the experts present. The noted writer perceptively describes the extensive and often grueling travels to which the child Mozart was exposed from the age of 6 to 10, under conditions which, in the middle of the 18th century, may have left him with lasting effects of the usual childhood diseases, very probably playing a role in his final illnesses, just short of his 36th birthday. In his wonderfully readable page-turner of a book, Mozart, A Life, Dr. Solomon devotes an entire chapter to the latter years of the composer's relationship with his father, from which we shall quote at length. But even earlier in the book, he writes, Mozart had become the object of a melancholiac's fantastic grievances against the world. Leopold Mozart complained that he had been reduced to poverty by his son's improvidence, and that soon he and his daughter Marianne could become indigent and forced to beg on the streets. Most harrowing for Wolfgang, he was accused of causing by his negligence the death of his mother, and to the list of his sins, Leopold suggested that he was capable of patricide. To Leopold Mozart, his son was indeed all-powerful, capable either of killing or keeping him alive. His feelings toward Wolfgang are a fierce bundle of contradictory impulses. We may sense in his fears about his son's safety a hint of a morbid imagination. A strain of embittered submissiveness runs deep within Leopold Mozart. He has crushed his own rebelliousness, but in so doing, his rancor has overflowed against his son, who still retains his defiant attitude, his refusal to submit. Unquote, Dr. Solomon. Now, over the last 200 years, the views by Mozart biographers about who Leopold was and what his role meant in his son's life has changed considerably. Some have admired his probity and high standards, and he well may have been right about Wolfgang's carelessness in handling of money, his tendency to gamble and take other chances. But whether or not these were at least in part the results of that upbringing, so dominated by the older man, has long been a subject of discussion. Study and interpretation of all the available sources has certainly not been kind to Leopold and led many scholars to find the relationship a gold mine for psychoanalytic inquiry. For example, we have Maynard Solomon's observation that, quote, Mozart could not remain altogether immune to his father's cautions against the dangers of sexuality, both conjugal and illicit. In the strange and disturbing riddles that Wolfgang penned and even sent to his father, in those equations of pleasure and mutilation, sex and death, orgasm and annihilation, we have echoes of Leopold Mozart's warning against what he viewed as the ensnaring, labyrinthine, contaminating woman, warnings by which he unconsciously aimed both to separate Wolfgang from his mother and to keep him for himself, unquote. In a chapter entitled The Myth of the Eternal Child, Dr. Solomon writes, Leopold Mozart regarded his son as his personal economic resource and insurance against the calamities of old age. Mozart was held to have an unlimited obligation to care for and support his family, to augment Leopold's salary, and to pay off the debts the father had supposedly incurred on his son's behalf. In the course of time, Mozart came to understand that his debts could never be paid in full. Leopold's struggle to control his son was a desperate one, for he was seeking to preserve not merely the source of his surplus income, but the integrity of his personality. Leopold Mozart would not, indeed could not, surrender his prerogatives, and he would try to thwart his son's every move toward independence and maturity. In the end, Mozart clearly understood that his father would never be reconciled to his departure from Salzburg to Vienna in 1781, his subsequent marriage, or even his brilliant career. He learned that his freedom would have to be purchased dearly. And after a passage that invokes Freud, Proust, and even Marx on psychoanalytic aesthetics and the battle against what is dead and gone, the author observes, throughout his life, Mozart struggled against the demands of his past, the survival of archaic patterns of behavior, and the incessant invocation of his childhood image, for these were largely insignia of the reenactment and perpetuation of ancient rites of submission. Unquote. Dr. Solomon frequently refers to Freud. In fact, his conclusions and speculations are quite solidly based on Freudian ideas. He quotes from Freud's study, beyond the pleasure principle, although he doesn't consistently defend them or consider them indicative of all of his own approaches. I understand that a number of copies of the book have been acquired by the office of the center. For those of you who may wish to peruse the entire whole remarkable Mozart biography with all its wide-ranging and deep-going insights, I understand that copies are available at Jane Kessler's Apple Tree Bookstore on Cedar Road near the Fairmount Corner in Cleveland Heights. The book contains, for example, a sub-chapter devoted to the so-called Zoroastrian riddles, Mozart's scribblings on playing cards about death and mutilation, pleasure and doom. It is highly psychoanalytic in nature, too complicated to deal with in this context. Dr. Solomon writes, seeking to establish superiority over his father, Mozart succeeds in quickening his own sense of dread. The riddles are the hieroglyphics of a secret discourse, a deadly play between father and son. The riddles may help us understand something about Mozart's personality, or even perhaps his creativity. For raw material such as these are better suited for psychological analysis than are structured works of art. The artist, remarked Freud in a famous passage, understands how to elaborate his daydreams. He knows how to modify them sufficiently so that their origin in prohibited sources is not easily detected. Early in his book, Dr. Solomon describes the outwardly happy child Wolfgang, who derived pleasure from his celebrity and its accompanying adulation. It was a seductive role for him. From the age of 6, he wielded extraordinary powers over his audiences, moving them to enthusiasm and rapture. And although he may not have been altogether conscious of it, he held great powers over his family, for he had become its main source of wealth and status. Breadwinner charged with contributing to the support of mother, father, and sister. There was no indication that the child understood the extent to which he had been converted into an instrument of patriarchal ambition and subjected to the inevitable resentment that attached to a father's growing realization that he had become deeply dependent on his little boy, unquote. There is much talk today whether there is too much pressure on children to excel and to achieve, and not enough time to play and discover. We hear a lot about the proverbial stage mother, of whom there always have been many examples in the artistic world. But here we have an instance of a stage father in its most overt and ultimately destructive manifestation, the kind of parent that every little leaguer dreads to see in the stands, or even on the field. In your circles particularly, you are familiar with women who are better at smothering than mothering, and men who act not so much as fathers than as movie-type godfathers. The author continues, Leopold Mozart had gained esteem, even glory, from his role as begetter, instructor, and impresario of so noble a creature. And he had seized every opportunity to turn the labors of his miraculous child into a cash equivalent, reaping extraordinarily large sums of money from the family's European tours. More and more, his career, financial health, and hunger for recognition came to depend on his son. And during years of almost non-stop travel, the Mozart family had grown accustomed to servants, private carriages, friseurs, and expensive clothing, and to the sense of superiority that attended their mingling with the highest levels of the nobility and intelligentsia. Not surprising then, Leopold came to fear that Mozart would grow up, that is, would cease to be a child. He felt an urgent need to exploit his possibilities before they evaporated. He wrote, "Every moment I lose is lost forever, and if I ever guessed how precious for youth is time, I realize it now." It is most telling, says the author, that as Mozart was approaching his teens, Leopold asked bitterly in a letter, "Should I perhaps sit down in Salzburg with the empty hope of some better fortune, let Wolfgang grow up, and allow myself and my children to be made fools of until I reach the age which would prevent me from traveling and until he attains the age and physical size that no longer attract admiration for his merits?" From dreading Mozart's maturity, Leopold eventually undertook to prevent it from coming to pass. Even in his adolescence and young adulthood, Mozart was not allowed to travel unless accompanied by his father, who made all the practical decisions and appraised every opportunity with a view to the family's interests. In time, neither distance nor the passage of time had lessened the overwhelming intensity of the entanglement between Mozart and his father. The matter reached perhaps its most poignant expression 1 year before the composition of the Zoroastrian riddles at carnival time in 1785, Mozart being that time 29. With Leopold Mozart's arrival in Vienna for a stay of 2.5 months. There he was subjected to a vivid and unrelenting demonstration of his son's triumphs as a performer, composer, and impresario at the pinnacle of his career. Within a space of only 6 weeks, Mozart gave numerous concerts, including some half dozen academies and subscription concerts. At the Burgtheater on February 13, he played a piano concerto in the presence of the emperor, who waved his hat and called out, "Bravo, Mozart!" Leopold Mozart was ecstatic in his description of these events in his letters to his daughter, and he had nothing but the highest praise for his son's music, calling one concerto very fine, another glorious, and one full concert magnificent. So moved was he by Mozart's performance on one occasion that for sheer delight, tears came into my eyes. In addition, he was daily witness to his son's warm acceptance by members of the highest strata of Viennese society, attending parties, balls, and banquets as part of Mozart's entourage. Perhaps the high point of all this was reached the day after his arrival, following a private run-through at Mozart's apartment of three of his string quartets in the presence of their dedicatee, Joseph Haydn. It was on that occasion that Haydn told Leopold Mozart what any father, and especially one who was himself a composer and court musician, would have longed to hear, that Haydn regarded Mozart as the greatest composer of the age. The author continues, "Yet it may have been during this visit that Mozart came to understand the extent and nature of his father's competition with him. He may now even have realized that his father's rejection of him went beyond alleged character flaws and a perceived abandonment, but extended to his creativity as well. It was surely inevitable that with each new evidence of Mozart's musical genius, Leopold would come to feel that the gulf between them had widened, intensifying his sense of being unneeded. Mozart's creativity itself became a hallmark of their estrangement and of his own impotence, even as it thrilled him to consider that he had fathered, shaped, and nurtured so miraculous a being. Each of Mozart's grand successes, imperial salutes, Haydn's encomium, popular acclaim, financial rewards, demonstrated once and for all that Leopold's parochial caution had been far off the mark. No one needed to be reminded that if Mozart had heeded Leopold's advice, he would still be court organist and composer in the service of the Salzburg Archbishop, and the operas and piano concertos that arose in response to opportunities in Vienna would never have been written. Thus, intentionally or not, Mozart gave his father a series of object lessons, even compelling him to acknowledge that Constanze's household management was both splendid and economical, and that the despised Frau Weber, his mother-in-law, was an elegant hostess and a good cook. Primarily, it was proof beyond question that Mozart himself, far from being an eternal child, was a conspicuously successful entrepreneur who was earning large sums of money and was beloved of Haydn, the emperor, the people, and the au monde. In brief, the visit had pulled down the entire family mythology, root and branch. Excuse me a second while I turn over this little private tape to discover all the mistakes I made.